As we move into hour three on this Wednesday on Talk of the Town, I am joined in the studio by my two regular guests on Wednesdays, Robert Metz and Jeffrey Schlemmer. Welcome to both of you today.
Morning, Jim.
I want to, on this edition of Left, Right, and Center, I want to move into an area that's kind of a touchy one, and I want to be very upfront with people. I think this is an issue that needs to be discussed, and I know that our two guests have some different perspectives on this. But what I will not allow this to turn into is a referendum on morality. That's not how I want to approach this issue, all right? So let me say that. We welcome your calls and comments, as always, but this is not about the morality of the issue. This is about the legality and the development of our laws and statutes in this country. The question that I want to address today, or the issue that I want to take a look at, is same-sex benefits. And again, not from a moral position, whether you think it's right or wrong, or the Bible says this, or the Quran says that, or whatever. But strictly from a societal and a legal point of view, there's quite a battle raging now at the higher levels of the courts across this country over the issue of same-sex benefits, not because of the same-sex element, but because the idea of extending these benefits to people who are not married in a conventional sense and are not opposite genders has moved so far from the original intent or the original purpose of benefits for survivors, benefits basically for spouses. Lawyers are arguing, and Jeffrey, I think it's in Alberta, aren't they, where they're kind of taking the lead on this argument that the Income Tax Act was intended to protect elderly widows, basically, of limited means. I think it was Paul Martin, I think, was fairly instrumental in doing that, or in updating it, in fact, maybe from R.B. Bennett's initial movement in this direction.
I'm not sure. I know there was a case that went to the High Court to within the last couple of years about the question of same-sex benefits, and it was a couple of fellows from B.C., I believe. And certainly the Alberta government is before the courts right now on the question of whether they should be required to have sexual orientation in their human rights code, which they don't right now, and the argument is that most other provinces have now adopted that, and therefore it's discriminatory in Alberta that it's not in there. I know the Supreme Court of Canada are considering that issue today as we speak.
Bob Metz, I want to start off by asking you, in terms of the original intent, do we have any argument here that the original intent was to protect elderly widows? Because I think if we go back into the history books, at least my reading and understanding is that is exactly why it was brought in. There was a concern about elderly women who are outliving their spouses and so on, many of them surviving in very penurious conditions, no extra money, eating dog food, the whole gamut of elderly poverty. Did anybody disagree with the idea that that's where the government was coming from initially on this?
Well, that's the justification that we all assume.
Okay. Given that that's where we started, we've come a long way to the point where people are now, and again, I don't mean to put this on a sexual or a moral issue, where people have gone just 163 miles down the road from where that was. Is it a good thing or a bad thing that our society has kind of broadened this, or is trying to broaden this and be more inclusive in this issue?
I think there's two completely separate issues involved here. One, the issue of, quote, same sex, as though the benefits were based on sex in the first place. I think this is a totally uneconomic relationship. But the other issue is exactly what benefits are we talking about? There's nothing on the private marketplace that would prevent two males or two females from taking out life insurance policy on each other, and if one dies, the other one collects the benefits. What we're talking about here is a government benefit. And to me, the moral issue is whether that benefit is even being administered and collected morally and in an appropriate way, even whether we're talking about different sex benefits. So to me, I see the issue as an argument between the private market in offering insurance and assistance and a separate issue of helping the widowed and basically people who are poor. One thing we tend to ignore, too, is that the elderly are generally among the richer class in society, a large part of them.
Today.
Yes.
Yes.
So, and we're making all these benefits for what we technically, economically, is one of the more, have to do people in society at the expense of the people who don't have money. And the younger people today are paying for these benefits, which are going to be very dubious whether those benefits are going to be there for anybody who's 20 or 30 years old today when they get old. So to me, the issue's got nothing to do with sexual orientation. It has to do with the viability of a pension plan or a government assistance plan to even survive in the first place when it's, again, I come back to this Rob Peter to pay Paul deal. If we all paid our own benefits and we all paid our own premiums and we all took care of ourselves, this wouldn't be an issue.
Jeffrey, from the left-ish side of the spectrum, certainly many of your cohorts on that side of this discussion have linked this with human rights, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Is it an economic argument that's gone awry, as Bob contends?
Well, it depends, again, where you come from. And I know my old tax prof used to just be appalled about the way the Income Tax Act is used to enact social policy. And he says that the Tax Act should be about getting revenue for the government. And when they're setting about what their policy is going to be, that should be somewhere else. Because, he said, the result is you end up with an extraordinarily complicated system that nobody understands and lawyers make a lot of money on. So he would have said you should separate those two functions out. Having said that, and I don't think this is... We often talk in law about the intention of the legislature. When they're interpreting statutes, judges have to consider the intention of the legislature as if there is one. And I don't know that there is here, but there may be a value in encouraging people to live together, just as far as sharing accommodation. And we've seen the move from benefits where you're married in a Christian marriage expanded now to, in most cases, include common law relationships, and the question is whether you extend that again into same sex, and then it should just be anybody who's got a roommate can take advantage of benefits. And I guess what it comes back to is there an advantage in having people sharing housing? I think there probably is. It's cheaper for two people to live together than for one. But it's not always the case. There are other situations where people are discouraged from living together. Certainly in terms of social benefits, the government is happy to pay a man and a woman who may date, may have sex and do everything they want together, but have to maintain separate accommodation. The government will pay two sets of accommodation for them, which is much higher than they'll get as one accommodation. And the reason, of course, is it costs more to rent two places than to rent one place. But there is a paradox in the sense that they will give more money to people if they live apart than together.
Well, they'll also give, in terms of tax breaks, people who do want to live together, but two wage earners, for example, two independent wage earners are going to pay a higher, even a bigger tax whack than if the government considered that income as one lump sum in a family. And this is a problem. A lot of people say this is a problem for families out there today. The tax burden is so onerous on them, particularly if there are two people out there earning, that we need to restructure that tax. And it seems to me this comes back to the same issue again. Originally, the idea was to facilitate family life, to encourage the nuclear family and so on.
Don't you see the paradox and the irony in what you're just saying there, that we now live in a society where the tax burden is so great the average person can't sustain it anymore?
Oh, yeah.
And yet those very taxes are going towards the benefits that everybody's hollering over, mm-hmm, that they want to have. And this is where the cord's got to be cut. We got to start being responsible for ourselves. We just create conflict and unnecessary, you know, problems in our society when we're always fighting for each other's money without having to earn it or without having to put some vested interest into it. To expect the government to constantly look after us from the cradle to the grave is a suicidal way of thinking. A society will die with that kind of a mentality. I think this whole issue of benefits is a red herring. We have to go more fundamental than that. Are these benefits justifiable in the first place for, you know, even regular couples? Why should one couple who's made choice to have children be subsidized by another couple who can't have children or choose not to have children? And why should an old person be subsidized by another old person, which is the way it works out, you know, because there's nobody who's going to escape the price of all of this. We may defer it once in a while, but we're going to pay big time. And I mean, the day of reckoning's coming.
But Jeff, aren't there some fundamental tenets of the philosophy of the left that would suggest that Bob's wrong on that? That we do have a societal responsibility, and we do have the option, the opportunity, and indeed the obligation to kind of tinker with society to try to make it better.
Well, yeah, and I guess one of the questions you come back to is, what do you do with the weak in your herd? You know, and in the wild, I guess you leave them behind and they're eaten by wolves.
Well, we're not in the wild, Jeff. We're in a civilized society.
Right. And a question of how you define what is civilized, one of the distinctions that I think you and I would make is a question of whether these benefits should be offered by private companies, which you could purchase, or whether they should be provided by government or not. Most of the things that you're getting in terms of the kinds of benefits we're talking about, health care, some kinds of insurance and stuff, are things that probably we would say we'd like to have for our own families. But the question is, how do we most efficiently provide them? And I think you and I come apart on whether it's more efficient to do it as a government or whether it's more efficient to provide it privately.
Well, again, you always seem to think that the issue is efficiency, and if totalitarianism serves efficiency, you'd be for it. And
I just want to bore you with my morality.
Well, to me, is that your morality? Is that what you're saying?
No,
are you agreeing with that?
I can talk to you about that if you want.
Well, please, I'm interested in knowing where you're coming from on that. Like, how far would you go with this obligation? You know, Jim uses the word societal responsibility. There's no such thing. Society is only a given number of individuals, so that the only thing we have is individual responsibility, and our social responsibility, if we want to call it that, is to not make ourselves a burden on others, not place ourselves in a situation, and to look after ourselves as best we can. Now, where people fail for legitimate reasons or whatever, there's always been mechanisms in society to look after that. The issue
sometimes
is...
Sometimes they haven't been too good.
Well, you know, if you want to provide the disadvantaged with the same standard of living as those who support them, that's a goal that's unattainable. It's not going to happen.
What about, Bob, put it into historical context, so you say we've always had mechanisms. I'd have to differ with you. There have been times when there weren't mechanisms. We think back to some of the stories my father told me about the Depression and so on, and how hard his father had to work, and the people next door where the fellow lost his job, and they lost everything they had, because, mm-hmm. I mean, they could go to the church and get some food.
That's the mechanism to which I'm referring.
They could come to our house, and Grandma would make them food, which she did a lot.
Right.
But they had no money to pay the mortgage, no money to buy clothing for the kids. It just didn't. I'm talking about the very early days of the Depression. The programs came in later on under Bennett's government and so on. But at that point in time, if you lost your job, or more particularly, if you became ill and couldn't work, you were screwed.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not talking here about benefits for poverty-stricken people. We're not talking about welfare. We're talking about same-sex benefits.
Yeah, but I'm trying to come around to what Bob said before. You know, there have always been mechanisms to protect people, and there haven't. Society has created these mechanisms to protect people.
Well, the things when you say mechanism, I think what you're saying today is a government mechanism, and I'm saying there's many other mechanisms. There's the mechanism you were just talking about in the last show, a lottery or gambling to help for charity. I mean, that's a mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
And my issue is, if we're going to be talking about living in a civilized society, that to me the measure of civilization is whether one uses force or not to initiate force against someone.
Mm-hmm.
Government social programs require that. Private programs do not. They operate on voluntarism. And if you look at those countries that instituted the kind of mechanism to look after all their ills through the government, you'll see countries that today, like the Soviet Union, which has completely collapsed because of that mechanism, is unable to get back up on its feet. It's been irreparably crippled. It's going to take years before the Soviet Union picks itself up, simply because it abandoned or never even considered the ideal of an individual free society in that sense. They went for the collective approach.
Benefits. They went a lot farther than that.
This is just one element of the same problem.
As a private model, I'd be interested, though, to see how, and not that I'm advocating it, but in a private model, I suppose, theoretically, if you wanted to buy benefits for a mate, you would just go out and buy them regardless of who the mate was. In some senses, it would be interesting to see how that worked. You know, if you wanted to have a same-sex person as your beneficiary, if you want to have your dog as your beneficiary, whatever, you know, you would just purchase that right.
Well, listen, the government taxes you for these benefits anyway. Why not just pay a premium into a real plan that's going to be there for you when it's time to collect? The government has a tax plan. It's not actuarially sound. The money, there's no account that says, Jeffrey Schlemmer, this is your money that you're going to have when you turn 65 or 70 or whatever the rules will be at that time. There's just the hope that there'll be enough poor suckers who are taxpayers that'll pay for you when it's your turn to collect. And that's not the way anything can operate.
Confederation Life, that we have companies that go bankrupt all the time.
643-1290 is the telephone number. *1290 on the Cantel Cellular. This is Left, Right, and Center with Jeff Schlemmer and Bob Met. The lines are open if you have a question or a comment. If you'd like to join the discussion, please feel free to call us. And that's what John has done. Good morning, John.
Yeah, good morning, sir. With respect to the discussion about rights of people to, how shall we say, participate in a pension.
Yeah.
Have any of you gentlemen read the book called The People's Rights?
Nope.
No, I haven't heard of it, John.
Can't say that I have either.
It was written by Churchill.
Mm-hmm.
1908.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a full chapter devoted to the people's welfare. And it was when they instituted the old age pension.
Mm-hmm.
And he pointed out that the necessity to introduce this was that because the poor did not have the opportunity or the inclination to, how shall we say, attempt to secure their future, given that their present was so uncertain.
Mm-hmm.
So, one of you gentlemen made a comment with regards to robbing Peter to pay Paul. Well, there's an old adage with respect to that quotation, which goes, he who robs Peter to pay Paul will always have the support of Paul.
Mm-hmm.
But with respect to the right of whoever, he makes mention with regards to the private sector and the insurance in the private sector. Insurance, after all, is a business. And the business is there is to make a profit.
Mm-hmm.
So is not the government, how shall we say, not a moral responsibility to make a profit, but a moral responsibility to ensure the welfare of its people?
Well, that's the very problem with the government, is that it doesn't operate on profit. It doesn't care how much it spends on the product as long as it can deliver it at any cost. And it's going to inflate the cost to whatever the bureaucrats and the people who administer it are, John.
But wait a minute, my friend. What bothers me is with respect to the unemployment insurance and its so-called surplus. Now, figures are thrown out to the public, and I am nowhere to determine as to whether these figures are, in fact, valid. But the question has come up now in the House with respect to the disbursement of this surplus. Now, my rationale, for whatever it is worth, is not only do you consolidate your position, but you ensure that that consolidation can be maintained. So to spend that money on something else, when its purpose was for the protection of those least able to withstand the economic times, to me, is robbing Peter to pay Paul.
And Paul will be eternally grateful, as you pointed out.
And Paul will be eternally grateful, Jim.
Yeah. Thanks for the call today, John.
You know, John does have a point there. Again, it's again the purpose for which money has been supposedly set aside. If I don't even believe there is a UIC surplus, it's just an accounting trick. But nevertheless, let's assume it were there. For the government to even be talking about spending it on something else than other than what it was collected for would, in the private sector, be regarded as outright fraud. I mean, no one could get away with that, you know. Mr. Smith, we're collecting your money for your pension, but hey, we're going to spend it on our holiday in Argentina or something, you know.
Sure,
you
our tire tax money has gone over the years.
and John also talked about the right to participate in a pension. Well, rights always include the right to say no. And the kind of pensions the government institutes are not the kind that you have a right to say no to. You are part of it. You have no rights. There are no rights involved. So while you know, people talk about having these rights, if you want a pension, what a right means in terms of a pension is that you have a right to take the action necessary to go to a private company, pick the plan best for you, and start putting money aside. Now, even if the government decided in its wildest fantasy that it could somehow help people out with their retirement and pensions, I think the only legitimate way they would even approach it, if they wanted to do it fiscally sound, is to sort of help those few people out, not a universal system, who need the help and only pay the premiums that other people would normally be able to pay. Why? That would be such a cheap system.
But the question then is, what do you do with people who can't afford to pay? Do you
subsidize what I just
them?
Said. That's what I just said. I said on the most outrageous situation, person can't pay. Government pays his premium, not his actual pension at the end of the ball game.
What's the advantage of that then?
So the money will be there when. You see, when I talk about a private premium, you have an account. There's an account there in the name of Jeffrey Schlemmer. Okay, I have an account, Robert Metz, pension plan. Nobody can touch that money. No other citizen.
Pension plans touch money all the time. That banks do too. Your money's not sitting if you've got an account in the bank.
Well, it's being invested.
It's not sitting there.
No,
it's
being invested, and that's the whole point. That's why the fund grows. Whereas with government, the fund is depleted all the time. There's nothing there to grow. It doesn't collect capital.
They invest it as well. That's not a distinction between the two. And as I say, to say that companies don't lose money, well, often they do. We've seen the stock burble in the past week.
But even if that were true, it's not an excuse for a universal system. It would still only be an excuse to help the people who were burned by the company that went out of business in an emergency situation. Even there, the argument for a universal system doesn't hold weight, I don't think.
All right, it's left, right, and center on 1290 CJBK, and we go back to the phones with caller Lee. Good morning, Lee.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Good. Very interesting conversation. What was just discussed just a moment ago, the one element that, you know, companies are in profit and loss, and yes, companies have gone bankrupt, and yes, companies suffer losses, but one thing that companies have a limit on is how much they can borrow and for how long they can borrow. And when governments can borrow ad infinitum based on the future taxation power of that government, I think everyone's at a disadvantage. And there's no accountability for the quality of service or indeed how those people who they allegedly are supposed to be benefiting are benefiting. And just to give a concrete example, I look at the education fiasco right now. Government had a hand, as did the teachers' unions, in creating the mess in the first place. And what you have are two monopolistic entities who are saying, well, we're going to change it and fix it. And I question, you know, how they are able to do that when they got us in this mess in the first place. Would it not be better to maybe privatize education and let the consumers, the people who are directly participating and ultimately benefiting from education, decide where they want to send their children? I send my kids to a Montessori school, and yet I also pay my property tax portion, the public education component. So altogether, I'm paying, you know, each year about $11,000. And I have no qualms paying for my kids' education, but I'm not deriving any benefit from the public system. In fact, I've taken my kids out.
I agree with you entirely, Lee, and I think you've hit the nail on the head on a number of issues. You know, when I hear the word no accountability, that's really the center of it. And when it comes to economic matters, I would just stretch that word a little to say no accounting ability.
Exactly.
There is simply no, just as I was talking to Jeff, there's no way that Jeff knows he's got X dollars in his pension when he turns X age. For example, listen to what we're hearing already today. Seniors were promised so many dollars per month when they retire at certain age. Now they're talking about cutoffs for anyone who earns over X dollars. In a private pension plan, that would be irrelevant. The plan sustains itself. It operates on itself. It doesn't care if you're rich or poor or if you've what your other status is.
But when part of that comes back to, you know, talk about companies as being the be-all and end-all. For instance, I'm aware that there are several class actions going on right now against life insurance companies over what they call disappearing premiums, where people had bought life insurance on the basis that they would be paid for on a certain date. They wouldn't have to pay any more after that. Mm. The insurance companies have said because interest rates were as high as they projected they were going to be, that now these people have to keep on paying, notwithstanding that people had contracted on the basis we don't have to know.
But in fact, if you read the fine print on those policies, it was stated in those policies that this was not a guaranteed return. The argument that the people are making is that they were improperly informed or whatever the case may be. But and I've seen one of the policies, I don't know, can't speak for all of them, but I've seen one of the policies and they're buried in the fine print, I'll admit that. But buried in the fine print is the reality that you may not arrive at this point when you think you're going to. We hope you do.
Yeah, well, it's full disclosure, you know, coming in the front door. But in any situation, there are no guarantees, and that includes government programs. Mm-hmm. And where we're seeing all of these things are in those things like the pension plans, CPP, or old age security. And the idea of robbing Peter to pay Paul, where Paul will be eternally grateful, well, that may well be, but...
The problem is you run out of Peter's.
Well, you run out of Peter's, and Peter's ability, A, to pay, and B, wanting to create a taxable event on their paycheck or whatever investment they might be indulging in. And I think you have a flight of the Peter's.
But you think, yes, that if Montessori ran the school system, would it be a lot cheaper than it is today? And if Montessori did run it, would you say that every poor kid should be allowed to go to Montessori?
I don't think anybody should be allowed to do anything just by virtue of their existence. I think that a Montessori would be one of many options. There would probably be similarly structured schools in a private system as there are in the public system. But what you would then have would be a quasi-market economy where it would be the obligation of the parents, as it should be in the first place, of determining what is the curriculum, how that curriculum is imparted, and hopefully there would be a track record by which you could judge standards and differentiate between good and bad schools. And
but who would have to go to the bad schools?
That would be a choice. I think in the free...
Nobody's going to choose to go to a bad school.
Well,
then there won't be any bad schools.
There wouldn't be. I think there would be an accountability, and it would be very much a competitive environment whereby people who may not have whatever the tuition would be at a so-called higher or more expensive school, let's say, whatever the curriculum is, the standards of those who aren't so exacting, I think, would come up. Strictly because they're in a much more competitive environment. Right now, it's monopolistic.
All right, Lee, I have to leave it there, but I appreciate you calling your comments.
Thank you, sir.
I'd like to run with Jeff's example where he was talking about an insurance company where people didn't know or didn't have full disclosure. And let's assume, for argument's sake, that small print you referred to, Jim, wasn't there.
Okay.
That, to me, is the very reason why we don't want government operating in this sphere. People should have a right to sue if a contract has been breached, and the government is supposed to be the referee. Now, if the government is both the referee and the provider of the service, do you really think you have a chance?
But it comes back to me, I always hear that you have choice with companies, that the consumer has a lot more power in relation
to
a company than you do in voting for a government.
Period.
I don't understand that. I look at, for instance, a company like IBM, that IBM was the be-all and end-all of companies until about 5 or 6 years ago when it crashed dramatically, lost billions and billions of dollars. And I don't see that big a difference between IBM and a mega government. It's large organizations that are inherently inefficient.
Well, I agree with you there. I'm not arguing with you there. A large organization that remains efficient is an extremely put together organization.
That'd be Microsoft.
I've worked for large corporations, and you can see when they start getting top heavy, but at least they collapse under their own weight and restructure and learn from their lessons.
Government does too. That's why the Reform Party are in opposition. You know, 10 years ago they didn't exist. We talked earlier about the government not having a limit on its borrowing. Well, we saw that they did. The IMF were coming down on the Canadian government back in the early 90s, and they were forced to pull up their socks. We have those similar controls for government as we do for companies.
But there are many people who believe that the IMS is an artificial pressure anyway on governments, that the government should just ignore them and keep going. And there are many, many people who don't believe that the wall's out there.
Well, I know, but this government thought it was there and did react to it.
Some people believe that you can just ignore the debt and make it go away. I mean, this is just a symptom of a total misunderstanding of economic reality and the way everything is so interlinked in society.
This is Talk of the Town. Also, it is Left, Right, and Center. We'll be back to talk with caller Jim and talk with you, too. The number is 643-1290. And caller Jim has been waiting very patiently. Good morning, James.
Good morning. Actually, I told Ryan my name was Paul. I want to be a Paul for today. One question, and then I'm just going to hang up and listen to the response. Why is it that in society, at least, we never limit ourselves to only one? For instance, we just don't have a Tim Hortons. There's a Robbins and a Country Style and a Donut Cafe, and there's Bay and Walmart and Zellers. But when it comes to government, they're so afraid of allowing me to be me and taking the $70 or $80 a month I pay every month now to CPP and letting me invest it on my own. What are they afraid of?
I'll tell you what they're afraid of. I'll tell you exactly what they're afraid of. They're afraid that if they leave it to your own devices, because you can't be trusted, the day will come when you're 60, 65, or 70, and you'll be lying on somebody's doorstep pleading for bread and a place to sleep. They don't want that to happen. They don't want to have to deal with that. And they see that the option is to force you today, to at least on paper, to force you to provide for your own future, because they don't want homeless, hungry hordes.
So if I sign in blood that I won't bother them, and then I turn 65 and I don't have funds, they
you
can
can't do that.
Not legally binding.
You can't do that. It's not legally binding.
It's kind of a sign that your life is not your own. Your life belongs to the state in this country.
And second question for Jeff. He was talking about bad schools and this. And I remember being in a sales meeting with the boss, and some of the sales reps were complaining about our prices. And the boss asked this question, and I'll ask Jeff. Jeff, do you always buy the cheapest or even worse, the least effective product on the market today? Do you and your wife always buy the cheapest?
No, I don't.
Oh, good.
But the concern is if you have people who don't have money, those are the ones who are going to end up in the bad schools.
I'm not talking about them, because we know for a fact that prior to 1963, before Medicare, 95% of people had private health insurance plans, and the system worked.
And again, it's a question of what do we do with the weak in the herd? Do we supplement them, or how do we deal with that?
But you know, the problem with that is you make it a blanket approach to everybody, and you take my freedom away in order to give him something else.
And when you mentioned that about the freedom aspect of it, I guess that's where RSPs come in, and the government does encourage people to buy RSPs and self-direct them. You have that option, but...
But why can't I take my CPP money and put it back in my RSP?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess, I'm not Paul Martin.
Welfare. That's what William Gardner says. He calls it welfare.
I'm not Paul Martin, so I don't know the answer to that. Although, again, I guess I have the sense that if the Reform Party or the government at some point in the future, and it appears likely they will be, that may happen. You know, stay tuned.
And the same approach with education, like give me the $4,000 tax credit, and where would I run to with my money?
Yeah, and certainly the thing about education is that nobody should think that it hasn't been tried before. We've only had universal education in this country for about 100 years. Prior to that, we've had private schools in European history going back for hundreds of years.
Exactly.
We've had terrific schools for wealthy people and no schools for poor people. And so that's been tried, all right, but what they found was you ran into an aristocracy that ended up a situation where the best and brightest didn't end up getting the education and running things. You ended up, it was the children of the wealthy who perpetuated themselves,
but
and
again,
they were inherently less robust.
But again, we have
the American system.
We have a situation here. Jack Granatstein was our guest earlier today with his book Petrified Campus.
Yeah.
He suggests that because we've sought this egalitarian model, access for everyone, that we have dumbed down our society.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I'd have to read the book. I don't see how having more education makes you dumb, but.
But Jeff, you use the word
lower standards.
You use the word wealthy as if it's a pariah.
No, not at all. No.
Let me ask you this question: how many people do you know today that choose between wealth and poverty?
I just don't think that wealth means brilliance. I think that there are a lot of very smart people who aren't wealthy, and those are people we should educate so that they could run things.
But nobody chooses poverty.
But they are.
Everybody chooses wealth.
It's like
at least a desire to have it.
I'm just saying that if we take all of, given sort of a random sample distribution across our population, the smart people aren't all wealthy. There are lots of smart people who are not wealthy.
Cool.
And if we say to them, you can never run things because we're not going to let you get into university, we're not going to give you education, then we as a society suffer because we're not as smart.
Who's saying that?
Well, I understand right off the bat that we've got all kinds of people saying you should get the education you can afford.
But see, that's the socialist dream, equal outcome rather than equal opportunity, because Jim Chapman's driving the big silver Lincoln, I'm entitled to one too.
No, not at all. I'm saying that the best and brightest, I keep saying that. I'm not saying that if you're not a bright person that you should get into a university. I'm saying that if you are a bright person and can't afford a university and we don't let you go, then we lose your expertise for our society.
You keep talking about the weak and the herd, like the rest of us.
I gotta go, guys.
Okay, thanks for the call, Jim.
Thanks a lot.
The weak and the herd that we have to help the weak and the herd, and yet you constantly are in favor of universal programs instead of helping just the weak and the herd. I'm sitting here saying that as a last resort, government can be used for that, but you want to see a universal system. So I see a tremendous conflict in your argument.
Well, universality, that's a whole other issue, and as I understand, it's an issue that's been debated since long before I was around, but I understand the rationale is that if a system is not universal, then it tends to get whittled away over time. But I understand the argument. Why not concentrate on the poorest?
Well, isn't what's happening here, you're talking about the herd analogy, isn't what's happening here is we're saying the whole herd, because there are some people who can't keep up in the herd, and they're going to get picked off if we don't do something about, seems to me where we are today in our social systems, our social services, is that we have told everybody in the herd to slow down. Nobody is to run faster than the slowest member.
No, not at all. And this is a system that, again, as far as I can tell, this is one of the main reasons why the United States became as prosperous as it did 200 years ago, and that is because they said everybody should have the right to become president. Everybody should have the opportunity to go as far as they possibly can, and the way we do that is by having universal education.
And yet they lead the world in elitist institutions.
Institutions. In post-secondary they do.
Yeah.
Certainly.
Yeah.
And that's another issue, and we're heading in that direction. And I don't know if I necessarily disagree. If you say we're going to have market rate for tuition for everybody, tuition will be $22,000 a year, but we're going to provide student loans such mm-hmm. that you can afford that.
Mm-hmm.
If you get a good enough job coming out the other end, then you can pay for it. Although, then it's a question of what if you're going to get a job that isn't going to allow you to pay off $100,000.
That's what Professor Granatstein was talking about this morning, 50-some PhDs in Canadian history this year graduating across the country. There's one job.
Right, and we are all paying for that. We're paying for a service we are not receiving. And I don't buy this argument that because somebody somebody's going to school, he benefits society, that that's why I have to pay for his education. I think that's the most absurd argument someone could think of to rip me off for my money.
Let's go back to the phone.
The season is young.
Yeah. We've got Bill with us. Good morning, Bill.
Morning, Jim.
Yes, sir.
This is the pension thing.
Mm-hmm.
Is this phone working all right?
Yeah. We hear you fine.
We hear you.
Yeah, okay. I've paid about $6,500 into the CPP. I started in 66 and run to 91.
Okay.
My pensional earnings, this is what I assume that I pay my premium on, run from $5,066 with $79.20
mm-hmm.
premium
mm-hmm.
to $92. My pensionable earnings were roughly $17,000. And I paid $335. I must have quit early then.
Okay.
But there is no possible way this thing could ever pay. I'm getting about $5,000 a year out of this bloody thing.
Mm-hmm.
And with me contributing $6,000, it's just impossible. I couldn't do it with a goddamn printing press printing $100 bills.
So what would what alternative would you like to have seen?
I'd have liked to have seen the total earnings contributed on. So instead of, say, 79, 80 bucks a year
yeah.
in 66,
yeah.
if it had have been $160, there is a possibility that the CPP would be doing what it should be doing, which is sustaining itself.
Mm-hmm.
But they hand this crap out, and I'm quite happy to be getting $5,000 on a $6,000 investment. Very happy,
mm-hmm.
and I think you would be too.
Yeah.
So the thing is not set up properly in the first place. Like 5,000 pensionable earnings in 66 up to only 30,000 in
mm-hmm.
91.
Mm-hmm.
See, the thing was not set up to make to sustain itself. It's set up for everybody to be paying forever. Like our school system.
That's absolutely right. And the politicians that brought it in from day one knew that, and they were telling that to the Canadian public, and the public just wasn't listening, or they didn't care because they figured 30 years down the road that wouldn't be a problem anymore.
But where's the money gone, though? It hasn't gone down a well. Either we haven't contributed enough to pay for itself, or we're taking out too much based on the premium.
We haven't contributed enough, but this is not our fault. This is the government's fault.
Well, isn't anything the government's guilty of, ultimately, aren't we guilty of it, too?
Give me a break. Do you think I voted for Bob Ray?
Mondo, who did you
vote
for?
He's not the government anymore.
No.
Well, that's the problem with the whole political system. I mean, voting is a way of avoiding responsibility, not assuming it. If we all voted individually in a marketplace, then we would be assuming responsibility. Politically, as I said last week, if we voted and only those people who voted for a program were obligated to support it, that would be accountability and democracy.
This must be Jeff, is it?
No,
it's Bob. Are you kidding?
Do I sound like Jeff with that argument?
Bill, we appreciate your call today. It's good to hear from you.
Okay,
you
bye-bye.
Take care now. Bye-bye.
Bye, Bill.
I'm going to pause for just a moment. Left, right, and center with Bob Metz and Jeff Schlemmer continue, or Bob Schlemmer and Jeff. We're not sure. We'll be right back. Look at the town, left, right, and center with Jeff Schlemmer and Bob Metz. And we've got Gord with us. Hi, Gord.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Yeah, I've been listening to your show this morning, and I'm trying to figure out where do I start here. I was listening to that call or the university professor this morning.
Yes.
And it sort of has something to do with what you're talking about now.
Yeah.
It just seems to me like there's a lot of good arguments, but it's like it's a lot of veiled agenda here. It's like a lot of these people are saying, oh, we want the pre-market and all this, and they're all assuming that they're going to be on the right side of the tracks.
Mm-hmm.
To paraphrase the song, what happens if, welcome back, baby, you're... Welcome back, baby, to the poor side of town.
Well, isn't the argument, though, that you have, it's your option, it's your opportunity. If you don't like being on the poor side of town, in a truly free and open society, you have the option to work your way out of there.
Oh, yeah, and I got nothing against that argument. Got nothing against that. But what happens? It's just like these teachers and CUPE members that voted for Harris for a tax break, and how they're getting a tax break is they're going to get laid off.
Yeah, but did they vote for the... we're getting a little off the topic, but did they vote for Harris because of the tax break? I didn't. I did vote for Harris. I've said that before. The tax cut had nothing to do with it, as far as I was concerned. And I know a lot of other people the same way, that, in fact, I kind of hope, I didn't think the tax cut was such a good idea.
Okay, well, that...
Gord, You're talking about a veiled agenda with respect to the free market. What agenda do you see there? I'm kind of at a loss as to what agenda you're talking about.
Sort of like the Simon Fraser, C.D. Howe thing. It's sort of like, okay, let's totally right-wing everything. And
well, you're using labels and you're avoiding the concrete reality of what you're talking about. Free market is simply people being allowed to choose the products and services that they want based on their own choice and not on someone else's choices. It doesn't mean that there's an unregulated market or like no rules or anything like that. It means we all play by the same rules. And to me, I see veiled agendas in every single policy and argument that tries to suggest some kind of collective security arrangement, because really what I see is a call for someone to get free insurance for themselves or to get free education for themselves and free health care for themselves. To me, that's a veiled agenda. I'd rather see people being open and honest about it rather than going through the political process to get what they should be doing on their own.
I got nothing against that, to tell you the truth. You know, it's just that I think there should be that safety net should be there, and I see an agenda to undercut that safety net. And I wife once in a while, I watch 60 Minutes, and I see stuff there in the States, and about private schools, about insurance companies, and you see all that goes on, that just the ripoffs. And do we really want that here? Like, we got to have some regulation,
but don't
or at
you
least
think
some safety net.
You don't think we're being ripped off with our education system? You don't think we're being ripped off through the government pension plan? You don't think we're being ripped off through UIC? You don't think we're being ripped off through our health care plan?
Well, I certainly don't think we are. If we are, where'd the money go?
Listen, I had a father-in-law who had triple bypass, heart surgery, living down in Florida, who could still pay private premiums that were about $3,000 a year. After having a condition like that, we pay a lot more per person in this country through taxes for our health care insurance. And, I marvel that people think that we're getting such a great deal simply because the price is being hidden from us, because it's in our taxes.
What?
If you actually saw the price of the actual services as they were apportioned out through our taxes, you would be running for the nearest free market you could find.
Well,
I disagree.
I've been down the States, and And people there, they tell me it costs thousands of dollars. They're in debt all the time to hospitals. But anyhow, it's like...
Well, we're in debt through our government. What's the difference?
Well,
you're indentured for life,
If it's not working right, it doesn't mean the idea is wrong. It just means people running are doing it wrongly.
Well, listen, there's nothing wrong with the concept of insurance and the concept of wanting to be protected and the concept of protecting people from losing home and all their valuables because of some sort of emergency service. But I'll tell you, the kind of social programs this government puts in the veil is that they use those arguments to justify programs that don't accomplish those ends but merely give the government more say and power and control over our lives. It's a terrible price to pay, and we're not getting the product that we're being bargained to get.
Gordon, thank you for your call today. Appreciate you joining us.
Okay.
Take care. Bye-bye. This is Left, Right, and Center with Schlemmer and Metz. I'm Chapman. I'm somewhere in the middle. Jeff Schlemmer on the left, Bob Metz on the right. Jeff, you made a comment a moment ago about... I don't know what you made a comment about.
That's been memorable.
That brain cell just died on me. Maybe this is as good a time as any to take a short pause, and we'll be right back. Jeff, it sort of came back to me. The brain cell is sort of flickering back there. The comment made about the American model there, that Gord made about the American model, and people always in debt and so on and so on. Would you disagree that the only difference between our system and their system is that ours is kind of hidden behind a curtain and theirs is out in the open? I mean, we are deeply in debt from funding our insurance system. It is a health insurance system, although it's been disguised as something else. Would you disagree with that?
I don't know how much of our debt is attributable to the healthcare system. I guess I'm aware that it seems like doctor salaries are considerably higher in the United States, but I don't know that much about the American system. But fundamentally, it is a good example of sort of the privately funded model with private insurance versus the publicly funded model. Although we saw in the first Clinton term, he talked about dramatically expanding healthcare in the United States, which would suggest that some people think it's not working so hot down there. On the other hand, it didn't go through, so maybe other people think it's okay.
Yeah, not enough thought it was doing that badly.
Yeah.
I want to come back if we can for the last couple of minutes. We started talking about same-sex benefits, and I said at the top of the show, it wasn't about sex, it wasn't about morality, it was about the expansion of government programs from their original purpose, and I think we can look at most of the government social welfare programs and see that today they are radically different from where they began. Same-sex, or the benefits, the spousal benefits, originally were designed so that, with no offense to anybody, the little old ladies could end their lives with a certain amount of dignity. Statistically, their husbands died earlier than they did. In the teens, in the 20s, and the 30s in this country, there were increasing numbers of elderly people who were living in poverty, and the government said, this isn't right, we have to do something about it. And now we're at the point where any two people who can get along with each other think they're a couple and want the government to provide these kinds of benefits. Jeff, I'm going to ask you, the couple minutes we've got left, is there any justification, do you think, for universality on this kind of an issue, or anybody who says, well, we are a couple, of whatever sort, we are a couple and we want access to these benefits, same kind of benefits that the traditional heterosexual couple has. We are a non-traditional heterosexual couple, or we are a homosexual couple. Do you think there's any rationale to have that kind of universality?
Yeah, I do. And I had mentioned at the start of the show that I think that there is a value in encouraging people to share accommodation because it's less expensive than having everybody in separate accommodation. Although, whether that, I don't know how far that takes you. I think, though, that where the government are running into now is a question of, where do you draw the line? Where's a logical place to draw the line? And the line has been moved quite a bit. It would seem to me that the next logical thing that will happen after same-sex benefits become the norm, as they are heading right now, is that we'll have a system where you'll be able to designate a person who's your beneficiary for whatever kind of benefits they are, because I can't see any way of shutting out those people.
Would it be any different if we actually paid into the benefit? Isn't that the problem here, that we're not actually paying it? It's not as though we bought us a policy.
No, you haven't got anything. You just got a promise of a bunch of politicians.
But the point I'm trying to make, Bob, is that if we actually bought a policy, I think you should be able to say, I want the money to go to my dog, my same-sex partner, or whomever. But that's not the situation
exactly.
Here.
Exactly. The government's controlling the whole agenda, and you really have a very limited package of what you can pick from. Individual responsibility is the only way to go with benefits, and in terms of assisting socially those who cannot assume their individual responsibility, that's a whole separate issue. That's an issue of welfare and not making things universal. Jeff, you keep going for that universality. I still maintain that putting everybody in the safety net means that nobody's holding it up. I don't know who you see as being the people who have to pay for the benefits if everyone's in the safety net.
Well, I pay for them. I get a service at the other end, and I pay for it every week with my paycheck.
Well, if that's true, then why bother with this whole government as a middleman? Why not just get why don't you pick where your money goes to the very service you want it to go? Why do you defer your responsibility in that respect to government all the time?
You trust companies, and I trust governments.
I don't think that's... You know why I think the reason is? I think the reason is you know that if the government does it, will also force me to support your causes.
Well, but you'll be supporting it if it's London Life the same way as you are.
Well, no, yeah. If I don't want to have a life insurance policy with London Life, I don't have to. I can go to...
Gentlemen, I hate to do this, but we've run out of time. Folks, please join us again next Wednesday at 11 o'clock when Messrs. Metz and Schlemmer will be back.